Support comes from the St. Louis Chamber Chorus. Season 68 concludes at John Burroughs at 3 p.m. on May 26th with the United Nations commissioned Voices of Today by composer Benjamin Britten, featuring youth and adult singers. Tickets at chamberchorus.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Danny Wisentowski.
And so this photo is still representative of his experience in the jail?
Yes, it is.
That's incredibly disturbing.
I don't care whose fault it is. It can be everybody's fault, but someone has to step up.
We rarely get a chance to see what it's like in a jail. Earlier this month, the public in St. Louis got that chance because of a disturbing photo taken inside St. Louis City's Justice Center. The photo shows the inside of a holding cell and a man lying on his stomach. The man is 35, accused of assault. He is paralyzed. A wheelchair is visible nearby, but he's not in it. The man's arms are folded beneath his head, and it's clear that he has soiled himself. The back of his pants is stained with feces. He had been in this condition for days, and when his attorney, Sue McGraw, saw him like this on April 1st, she did something about it. She took a photo. McGraw went public with the evidence of her client's conditions, and in response, jail officials flew into action against her for taking and sharing that photo. The blowback has had a clear direction, not over what the photo showed, but the fact that it was taken at all. And now, a new policy in St. Louis City's main jail is hitting back at attorneys, barring them from bringing in phones and even restricting their ability to give paper records to their clients. It means those attorneys' jobs have gotten a lot harder, and that's not good for those lawyers or their clients who are trying to survive in an overcrowded jail. And it's all because one lawyer saw something wrong, and took a photo of it. And to explain why she did that, and to talk about the backlash that attorneys in St. Louis are now facing, I'm joined by Sue McGraw, director of the Criminal Defense Clinic at St. Louis University. Sue, welcome back to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you, Danny.
Sue, before we get into this photo and your client, talk to us about your legal clinic. This is the reason you're coming into this jail twice a week. What is it that you and your students do here?
Well, Danny, my students and I interview people and get them ready for a detention hearing. Everybody who gets arrested and taken to state court has the right to have a bond hearing. Now, the public defenders can't enter at that initial bond hearing because of a paperwork snafu with Jefferson City. So my students and I volunteer to come in twice a week. We interview people who are trying to be released from detention, and we do it kind of as a public service. It's win-win. The students get experience and they get free labor.
And now these folks, they've been accused of crimes. They're not convicted of crimes. And, you know, the jail or the jail officials, they don't want to keep everyone. This is why bond hearings and why these systems exist. Some of these folks can be released and some of them might not, but you have to figure out which one is which, right?
That's right. And so what we do is prepare a case for the judge to argue that they should be released.
And without you, these folks would just be sitting there waiting for public defenders.
Some of them would. Some of them would have contract attorneys.
Right. So there are a lot of figures here, and this is a very critical and initial stage of the criminal justice process. Now, I want to get to what happened on April 1st, because you went in there to see your client, Lamar Pearson, who is aware that this photo has been shared, and you went to see Lamar, and you saw basically, the scene I'm looking at now is this photo. It was published by the Riverfront Times. That's where you gave this photo. He's lying on the ground. It's disgusting. It feels bad to look at it. It is a picture that is not dignified. I would not want this picture of me ever to be released or someone that I cared about. Why did you take this photo and release it?
I took the photo because I knew nobody would pay attention to yet another bad story coming out of the jail. And I knew that if I had a picture of it and people saw what it looked like, that it would affect them on a more emotional level. I also had my doubts as to whether anybody would admit that had happened unless I had a photograph of it.
What did you learn about how he had wound up in this condition?
Well, Mr. Pearson had told me he had been in this condition with no ability to toilet himself, no ability to clean himself for a couple days, 2 to 3 days. What I was later told by Vernon Betts was that he had been in the holding cell, which is police area, which is in the basement of the detention center.
Right. And Vernon Betts, that's the sheriff of St. Louis City.
Yes, it is.
Right. And this question of where was Mr. Pearson, who was in charge of him, that this becomes an issue that is still playing out, as we're going to learn. But tell me, you walk us through, you see him in this position. Are there officials around you? What brings you to that moment to take your phone out and do something that the rules say you're not allowed to do?
Well, my students and I went back to, and so we had four people we needed to interview, and the sheriff, and there are probably three or four sheriffs in the attorney area, and then another four, five, six roaming kind of the hallways outside the holdover. And we gave them a list of the people we were set to interview, and a sheriff came and said to me, Mr. Pearson, you can't see him. He's in a wheelchair. And he had an accident on himself. And I said, well, I have to at least talk to him. So I went to the holding cell, and there he was laying on the floor. And of course, I can't communicate with someone through glass. So the sheriff opened the door, and initially we stood in the doorway and were talking to him. And all he could really do was lift his head up off the floor and give us answers. But the answers were very abbreviated. As you might imagine.
Your client is paralyzed.
Yes, he is, from the chest down.
And he'd been in this position for days.
I don't know if he was on his belly for days. He'd been left covered in his own excrement for days.
So you take this photo and you give it to the Riverfront Times, Ryan Kroll.
Yes.
They publish a story on this the next day. And that triggers a series of events that are still playing out right, you know, this day, as we've been getting updates. And the first thing that seems to happen is that you are barred from seeing more clients in the jail, I understand.
Right. So the next time I went back, we followed our normal procedure. And you need to understand that the jail has a little section that's separate. And it is what the sheriff uses to hold people who have to go to court. And so we do what we do every time. We've done since January. One of the sheriff supervisors opened the door and said, only contract attorneys in pretrial today. And I said, I am a contract attorney. We discussed it. And I finally looked at him and said, is this about me? And he said, yes, this is about you. You can't come in.
Wow. And now this was not the first change, I should mention, but there a sign went up on the door of the Justice Center on April 5th, I understand. This is just a few days after the photo is published. And what this sign says is that all attorneys and court personnel have to store their cell phones before going in. It was banning bringing in phones to the jail, I understand. And this was a big deal.
Well, the first thing was that Vernon Betts issued an order telling all court personnel and lawyers that you can't bring a phone in his section of the jail. So this is the holdover section of the jail. And we were eventually allowed back in because Judge Elizabeth Hogan from the 22nd Judicial Circuit, she's the presiding judge, ordered him to allow us in.
Right. And that notice that goes up about the phones, did you know it was about you at that point?
Oh, yeah.
Right. And this seems like maybe a minor thing, and maybe they're saying, oh, you took a photo. But this not having your phone as an attorney in this scenario is cutting off a real serious resource for you and these people, your clients, who have no other connections.
Right. It is the only way for us to pull up court records while we are in there talking to our clients. So let's say they have another case and they need to know the court date. Where is that pending? That's one thing we need our phones for. We also have to call people's families and say, can they come live with you, or people's employers? And of course, we can't do any of that without our phones.
Now, I wanted to talk to another attorney to kind of get an understanding of how big a deal this was. And I talked to an attorney named Nikki Moody earlier today, and she said that the idea of banning phones as a response to a medical condition that's not being addressed, it's just the wrong move.
The reaction of banning phones, I don't think is the right answer. I think the answer to that problem would be to fix what's going on there and provide more medical support and make sure that people are being treated like that, not to ban phones because somebody is trying to expose it.
Sue, what did you think of that point made by Nikki Moody? I mean, the reaction to just say, oh, someone blew the whistle, we got to make sure someone doesn't blow it again or see something else. Was that the right move?
Oh, of course not. I mean, the one thing I haven't heard from anyone during this whole time is what changes are going to take place to make sure that another person isn't left in this situation. And no one has given that answer. They're obfuscating the obvious issue by making it about me taking a picture with my phone. And it's really just kind of smoke and mirrors. What we want is an answer to how are you going to make sure this does not happen again.
And so on that point, you were barred from seeing your clients when you returned to the jail, and this led you to actually go to the presiding judge who made a couple orders. One of them was for you to see your clients, and another one was to have Mr. Pearson be taken to a toilet, to be given his accommodations, to address what was happening. Has that happened?
No, it has not. I met with Mr. Pearson this morning. I check on him weekly because we're really concerned about his health. He normally takes several medicines. He is being given one nerve-blocking medicine of his physician's prescribed prescriptions. He is not being given a blood thinner that he needs to take three times a day to prevent from getting blood clots while he sits in his cell. He has other painkillers. He's in constant pain. They won't give him those. He is not getting assistance using the toilet. He has gotten to the point where what he has to do is just go ahead and relieve himself and then ask for different clothing.
And so this photo is still representative of his experience in the jail?
Yes, it is.
That's incredibly disturbing to hear. I'm curious, as you were going through the days last week, you know, what were you thinking about? Were you thinking about how he was doing? How do you keep going through the job that has so much paperwork and so much technical stuff, and there's a man in distress who is surrounded by people who are not helping him?
Right. I mean, the problem becomes that criminal defense lawyers now have to fight not only a battle in court, but we have to fight the jail administrators. And I have to have an argument with Vernon Betts. And it makes a client almost a full-time job. Now, I'm lucky because I have a decreased caseload. But people who are public defenders who have 100 cases and see this kind of thing all the time, it is unreasonable to expect them to be able to keep up with the kind of paperwork that I am able to keep up with.
Now, this is not the first time that a photo taken in this jail has led to a phone ban. In January, a different attorney shared a photo of her client's untreated hernia. He had just pulled up his shirt, you know, and taken a photo of it. The attorney had taken a photo of it, that is. And there was an order that came out from the Commissioner of Corrections that beginning January 15th, banning cell phones. What happened to that policy? I understand that did not stick as strictly as it seems in writing.
Correct. So what happened after that was that if you wanted to bring your phone in to the jail, and again, this is not the holding area that Vernon Betts has control over, but the CJC itself, you had to get permission. And I think your listeners should understand that there's all sorts of video documents that we are obligated to show our clients. And not being able to bring a phone or a laptop in means that our clients aren't getting to see the evidence against them. And that's a clear constitutional violation.
Now, I wanted to get to kind of the reaction from the officials who have been impacted in this. And part of the complexity here is that there is not just one group enforcing the law in the city justice center. There's actually three. There's the city police, there's the sheriff's department, and then there's the corrections staff. Help me understand, part of the mystery here is who was responsible for Mr. Pearson at the moment, you know, that led to him in that condition. What do we know about that?
I know that Vernon Betts told me he'd been left in police custody and then brought up. And then Vernon Betts told me that he is not responsible, that that is part of the CJC. But then when Vernon Betts imposed his camera ban in his area of the jail, he seemingly admitted to control over what happens in the detention holding area. He has since, I guess, in a new statement said that it's not him, it's the CJC. And I don't care whose fault it is. It can be everybody's fault, but someone has to step up. I mean, these are public officials. They are accountable to the citizens in St. Louis, and they owe everybody an explanation as to why my client was left there. And he has suffered further medical injury as a result of being left lying on his stomach on concrete covered in excrement.
So let's walk through some of what the officials are saying, because it is a little dizzying because of the situation of multiple enforcement groups over the jail. On April 2nd, after the Riverfront Times published its first report, KMOV reached out to the city's public to the agency that's in charge of the St. Louis City Police, and they kind of set, as you said, they said it was originally the St. Louis Police who had processed Mr. Pearson on March 29th. He was in police custody until April 1st, and then transferred. During that transfer, you know, to a holdover facility, that's where he was experiencing symptoms of detoxification. This is the Department of Public Safety's explanation for all of this. And so the Department of Public Safety says it was the sheriff who was escorting Pearson, and so it was the sheriff who was in charge. Vernon Betts responds to KMOV, says, this is a lie. He rejects it. I reached out to the sheriff's office last week trying to get some clarity on this, and I received a response from the sheriff's office attributed to Sheriff Betts. The first line of the statement is, it's essential that your audience understands that as sheriff, I do not run the city justice center. So he's saying he wasn't in charge. He wasn't in charge of Mr. Pearson's visitation, medical care. That was all on the police. He's saying, but Sheriff Betts did note that he is appalled by the unsafe and unsanitary conditions that Mr. Pearson endured while being detained in the justice center. He said the city administration must be held accountable for their failure to protect the basic rights of Mr. Pearson. And so what do you make of Sheriff Betts' responses here? He wasn't in charge. He wasn't responsible. But somebody else has got to take responsibility for this.
Yeah, his sheriffs were in charge of my client. One of their obligations, one of their primary obligations, is to handle the transportation of detained people back and forth to the courtroom. It was the St. Louis City sheriffs who had the key to the door that unlocked the cell for me to see my client. And I want to add that my client had looked up at one point at the city sheriffs when we were in there and said, man, you got to give me something to clean myself with. I'm going to get a staph infection from a sore on his buttock. And the sheriff said to him in front of me and my student, Michael Shea, use that wrapper from your sandwich to clean yourself up, pointing to a piece of saran wrap that had been around a bologna sandwich, which the sheriffs had placed on the floor. And she said, you know, sometimes we just need to improvise. And we were stunned.
And I should note, the photo you released, it shows that sandwich. You know, it is in the frame of the photo, you know, lying on the ground next to him. I wanted to get to some more developments as things are still happening. Today, another sign was put up. You sent me a handwritten transcription of this sign, I'm guessing because you couldn't take a photo of it.
Because I couldn't take a photo because I didn't have my phone.
This sign indicates another important policy issue, and whether it's being changed or not is another thing to discuss. But This involves the paper pass, you know, an actual physical slot that you are able to give documents to these clients. That is no longer open to you.
No, that has been locked by the jail. And I should say, I just saw the sign today. The date on the sign is April 1st. I do not know when it went up. So we need paper passes because, as you can imagine, there's all sorts of paperwork we need to discuss with clients. We need to show them evidence. That has since been locked, and the sign says that we need to put the materials in a basket to go to our clients.
When was the last time you had access to that paper pass that you can recall?
Oh, I mean, I can't recall.
Hmm. So I should mention, because this is a bit of, you know, genuinely a question of, you know, chicken and egg, I guess. I reached out to the Commissioner of Corrections, and I received a response today about the paper pass. And that response claims that on April 1st, there was a policy to prohibit attorneys from using a paper pass slot to transfer documents. They wanted to prevent contraband, such as unauthorized electronic devices or synthetic marijuana. They've made some other changes. But the timing of this seems so striking to me. The same day that you witness your client in a state of medical distress, that you share the photo with the media, that same day the corrections department said we're banning attorneys from using the paper pass. Can you make any sense of that?
I can't, and I should point out that many of our clients are illiterate. So to cheat us out of the ability to go through a document while they have it and we have it at the same time greatly hinders our ability to provide effective assistance of counsel. I don't know why they did the paper pass ban. You can get maybe 4 or 5 sheets of paper, if that, through that pass. It's very, very thin. You can't even pass a pen through that paper pass.
Are you aware of problems with attorneys passing synthetic marijuana or electronic devices?
You couldn't fit an electronic device through there unless you completely dissembled it and pushed it through, like, little bit by little bit. It is too thick.
And by not having access to that, what are your clients not receiving?
Oh, they're not receiving discovery. They're not receiving things. I don't know if they're getting what's left in the basket. I am not comfortable leaving a confidential document for my client in an envelope that the jail can access. And I'm sure all the other attorneys feel the same as me.
You know, we heard from criminal defense attorney Nikki Moody earlier. And when I spoke with her this morning, she expressed a concern of what this means for the overall conditions in the Justice Center.
I hear from numerous clients of mine that they, you know, especially when they're first brought in, they sleep on the floor. They don't have access to bathrooms. They don't get to take showers. They're just really horrible conditions. And there are people that are being charged and held with no bond and being forced to be in these conditions before they really have their due process.
And that was criminal defense attorney Nikki Moody, who talked to me earlier today. You know, her point kind of goes to a message we actually received from a listener who's concerned overall about the conditions of a jail where a man who is paralyzed is left in a room. Why would a paralyzed individual who has a lot of special needs, why is he in the jail at all? Isn't there another way?
Well, there is a way. We moved for a bond reduction for him to get out, and that was denied. I can tell you that it has been eye-opening to me, even after 35 years in the criminal justice system, to see just the depths that the jail is sunk to. I had a client who tried to commit suicide. He went to Barnes. The physicians at Barnes prescribed medication for him, and the jail never gave it to me. I had a mother stop me and say, my son's having seizures, and the jail isn't giving him his medication. It's appalling.
You know, I had put in a request to the Commissioner of Corrections. I asked, what are they doing about you know, someone like Pearson being in that situation. They said they are getting a one-year emergency contract with a physicians group, $2 million to fund new positions, including a chief medical officer. Very briefly, you know, is that enough?
Well, once they hire someone, they're going to have to get up to speed. And no, it's not enough. You cannot deny people medicine. You cannot deny them treatment because you are unable to successfully run the jail. I hope your listeners understand that these are people with really serious conditions, people with epilepsy, people with inherited diseases, people with very, very serious mental health problems. They can't go anywhere else. The court won't let them out. The jail won't give them treatment. They are condemned to die and suffer in this jail.
And now their lifeline is being cut. Once again, Sue McGraw, director of the Criminal Defense Clinic at St. Louis University. Sue, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Danny.
This episode was produced by Danny Wissentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on The Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.